Blog Talk Radio.
WPR Rebuttal is on the air.
Well, you just heard my new introduction. I recorded and mixed it myself. Welcome to WPR Rebuttal, covering the size of the story missed by Wisconsin Public Radio, bringing you narratives the UW system Board of Regents won't allow, and shedding light on perspectives the owners of WPR don't want you to hear. So last week, I had applied for director of administration for and in response to my timely application, the program manager gave me, or rather the management analyst, I should say, sent me a list of 5 essay questions, which were then due back to her within 7 calendar days. And I used the full allotment of time, even down to the 11th hour. I literally sent this at 11:59 p.m., not a.m., but p.m., 11:59 at night yesterday, so as to meet that 7-day deadline. Because I was thinking mentally that I had applied on Friday, when really I had applied on Thursday, but the Thursday seemed Friday because of all that was going on in terms of preparing for my podcast and commenting on WPR articles and all that other stuff. And really, it seems like just about every day I'm preparing some type of social media remark or podcast content and so forth. And thankfully, the two blend together so I can repurpose material for different media so as to maximize exposure. But, of course, and my responses to them, well, they stand to inform about the trends in public administration as well as to urban planning in general. And I just want to say, if there are any public administration graduates or anyone else who wants to call in and comment, our number at WPR Rebuttal is 929-477-3965. Again, that's 929-477-3965. So, first question from Lodi, Wisconsin is, what strategies would you use to assist elected officials in developing policies? And how would you approach implementation of these policies once they are adopted? In my response, as director, I would confer with and provide operating information to the mayor and the common council to ensure they have an accurate gauge of progress on implementing their goals and are clearly informed of anything necessary that I don't already have to steadily progress towards council-established goals in a proper prioritization. By providing iterative feedback as necessary or when requested, I would alert our elected officials as to inroads made and difficulties faced. I would also work with whomever the mayor feels would be a strategic partner, internal and or external, depending on council appropriations, for the initiatives thus laid forth. The mayor and common council would thereby steer me in terms of what they expect, and I would row the best I could by identifying and acting upon necessary project management timelines, workflows, and deadlines, such as to finish a feasibility study and budget segment request by the April 1st budget submission deadline. If I saw trouble ahead, such as insufficient resources or unforeseen delays, then I would explain why the problem arose and identify feasible alternatives that the alder persons and mayor could choose as a new direction. And, of course, when I was reciting my response, by the way, I sent these in written format. They haven't interviewed me yet. But when I'm reading these aloud, it's good practice for a potential interview because just within the past minute, I almost said Aldi persons instead of older persons. And it's funny because I have advertised Aldi on my podcast along with Dollar General and Airheads Candy. So that's just some continuity. You could say it's a shout-out to some history on WPR Rebuttal podcasts. So, second question from Lodi, Wisconsin. What are the similarities and differences between the roles of a mayor, alder persons, and directors in their work for a city? Well, I didn't say this in my response, but grammatically speaking, the question should have been, what are the similarities and differences among the roles of this, that, these, and those? Because differences implies between two, among allows for more than two. At any rate, my response to that question was, alder persons are elected representatives who comprise the legislative body or common council of the city. They exercise the greatest authority because they have purse power, appropriations authority, zoning power, land use designation authority, and appointment power, approval disapproval authority over each personnel selection. The mayor is an elected manager who sets departmental goals that align with the mandates decreed by the county council. The mayor is similar to a project manager because he or she is charged with estimating the time, personnel, and materials necessary to implement the goal, as well as allocating sufficient resources to this end and monitoring progress. By these considerations, the mayor is therefore the president of the city. Now, say CEO of the city would be more apropos of a city manager rather than a mayor. And, I just said that in passing in my response, but I'll elaborate right now. Okay, so the president is directly elected, or rather elected by Electoral College, but Electoral College is informed by direct election. Now, CEO is not elected. I mean, the CEO can be appointed or rather approved or disapproved by the board of directors, but the CEO is not accountable to the public like the mayor is. But then again, the mayor is not accountable to citizens of our cities. So in that respect, he or she is kind of like a local president and must be more publicly, civically minded than a CEO would need to be. Now, going back to what I actually wrote, directors are appointed or unelected technocrats, which are apolitical experts. And they operate and manage a particular type of professional service. This can be budget, finance, and bond issues. It can be utility control and planning. It can be human resources and benefits administration and any other department that a city might have. And these directors are usually chosen by a collaborative process in which the mayor, the human resource director, and key personnel within the particular department of operations where he or she would work, thereby identify an appointee who is then introduced to the county council for potential approval and hire or possible disapproval, in which case a runner-up candidate would be considered. Now, directors cannot unilaterally set goals. They must confer with and provide operating information to the mayor and to the county council, and that is their means of measuring progress, their means of identifying next steps in the progression of council-established goals. Like I said earlier, the common council and the mayor steer the directors, and the directors provide the actual work hours to go and pursue the implementation of these goals, whatever it might be. So third question from Lodi, Wisconsin, regarding the position of director of administration. And if anyone wants to weigh in on these, again, our number at WPR rebuttal is 929-477-3965. So the third question is, what characteristics do you feel are important in a director? Describe your management style. My response is a responsive director is a must. Some experts are outright offended when they are second guessed. But I accept criticism and find common ground as to the merits and drawbacks of an approach. It is critical to focus more upon a solution to a problem than to concern oneself with assigning blame. Furthermore, I am willing to accept some blame for conditions I might not even be able to control, so as to provide a pressure valve on citizen and coworker frustration. I prefer to actively listen and paraphrase what an interlocutor tells me. This ensures I sufficiently understand what he or she is attempting to communicate, as well as strengthens trust. An ideal director will also work outside office hours when needed. I have no barriers to fulfilling my duties of office beyond normal business hours. But I will be considerate to not draw attention to how much time I put in, lest our directors feel I'm setting a more arduous precedent. And because the director administration salary is above $47,476 annually, I would be exempt from the latest rendition of the overtime salary rule enacted by the U.S. Department of Labor, which will become effective December 1st, 2016. And finally, as demonstrated as Chief of Human Resources for our Student Association at UW-Milwaukee, my management style is to delegate based on other strengths. In other words, to be hands-off in their fort and to assist others with their weaknesses, or be hands-on where to stretch thin. Moving on to question four, this position serves as a working director. What is your direct experience in governmental accounting and financial report in budgeting, human resource functions, and economic development? Well, my response is, as procurement clerk for a student association at UW-Milwaukee, I utilize effective inventory management, including access control and predictive ordering. This was my formative experience in governmental accounting, as I successfully matched signed checks to invoices by fiduciary amount, by department, date, and by order number. Upon promotion to Chief of Human Resources, I maintained a personnel budget of more than $1 million. This required maintaining an accurate operations costing model by which to forecast expenditures against appropriations and thereby plan headcount, the recording of time and attendance in PeopleSoft, the entry of journal entries in Sage 50 accounting software, which for your listeners used to be known as Peachtree, and the creation of financial spreadsheets in Microsoft Excel, whereas regular occurrences in my administration of duties as were face-to-face briefings about personnel matters. Also, as Chief of Human Resources for Student Government at UWM, I maintain behavior files, seniority information, and time and attendance logs for 48 employees, once again totaling $1 million in payroll. I also acted as a primary point of contact for information on benefits, including paid leave and health insurance. Now, perhaps my greatest achievement in that role of Chief of Human Resources was to develop and implement a lifecycle recruitment and retention staffing plan. This involved job analysis to determine accurate knowledge, skills, and abilities, followed by the writing of revised position descriptions involving these updated KSAs. Intra-term turnover subsequently fell 33%. While Cheese Packer Saputo, I suppose I shouldn't say which company. Okay, so I had applied for Saputo, but they did not hire me. Okay, I'm just still a temp through a staffing agency. I won't say a staffing agency, but I almost said on air, I almost implied like where I work. But I'm just going to keep that a secret. No, I don't work for Saputo. I work for a staffing agency, okay? And both the staffing agency and the cheese plant have so many branches that really no one could really say where specifically I worked. And that's good just because people will go and they will go, they'll just make a big deal out of everything, and they will quote things out of context, and they'll try to make me seem rude and aggressive when really, for those listening to the podcast, that's not the case. For those who know me offline, they know that I'm a polite, amiable coworker, and it's just there are always going to be some demented people who go and try to stir up trouble. Those are people you call big spoons because they're always stirring up stuff. Okay, so while Cheese Packer at my staffing agency job, and my in my essay to Lodi, Wisconsin, I identify where I work, obviously, because they have my resume. But for the sake of reading on air, I won't say exactly where I work. But I developed an intimate understanding of the need to have the human resources and safety manager periodically observe workers in every department in order to develop a worker's view and an accurate description for each position. The need to understand potential workflow bottlenecks and occupational hazards applies to everyone, from the street sweepers and public works technicians to the comptroller and IT technicians. My experience in economic development includes insider's view as a worker, as a job seeker, and the person who has hired from amongst those within the former two groups. In other words, like, okay, so I only had a maximum of 3 pages by which to express myself. And really, I had to shrink the font size from 12 points to 10 points because at 12 points, I was creeping into 5-page territory. And to make the 3-page cutoff, I just had to shrink my font to a still legible 10 points. But the whole point of me sharing that variety of experiences to show that I'm well-rounded, I come in with a broader perspective than some person who's used to just delegating. I mean, I've actually done a lot of different work from blue-collar to white-collar, and I know which jobs delegate in a certain proportion to our jobs. In other words, I'm pretty familiar with how many Indians we need, so to speak, to support a particular number of chiefs. And that's really important because a lot of people, especially people who are considering college, they tend to presume that there can just be all these skilled positions and all these internships, and they can help with office work, but really there's so much non-office work, so much manual labor that needs to be done in order to support the existence of even one critical role. Like manufacturing plants are a perfect example. The support, triple digits in actual assembly line workers and other blue-collar laborers such as maintenance people, you only need a receptionist, a human resources person, and maybe definitely an occupational safety and industrial hygiene inspector. But other than that, those three white-collar people, most of the people in a given productive organization are going to be blue-collar. I mean, maybe you might have few law firms with white-collar people, but really it's just you need so much of a population to even support one lawyer. And depending on the income level of the per capita income level, and that can vary, but you really need at least 500 people per lawyer. Actually, I guess more like 1,000, because a rural lawyer would have to go and travel amongst a few different counties in order to get enough clients to justify having an office. And really, so many people are needed to support, even the practice of one lawyer. That's why the lawyers tend to be in the big cities, because if they were to try to be entrepreneurial and hold a practice out of their home in the country, they would not have enough customers. I mean, they can't just sit at home and run a rural lawyer practice because they would not have enough customers. That's why most lawyers have offices in the city, because they try to work from home as a lawyer, they just aren't getting enough bread coming in. So at any rate, that was not part of my actual written essay because of space limitations, but it's a perfect example for my listening audience as to how we need to plan to have more manual laborers and just plan to accommodate them, because without them, you aren't going to have enough people to support and patronize these white-collar people who get higher pay and whatnot. And this is part of the reason why so many college graduates are unemployed, because they don't recognize until it's too late, if ever. A lot of underemployed grads still don't recognize the economic realities of having many blue-collar people for each white-collar person. That's just economically, you can't have a bunch of white-collar people supporting each other, because it just costs too much. You'd have to lower down their prices, and then they'd have to take on a second job, like a MIC job, and that'd make them actually semi-blue collar then, because, again, it's just a vicious cycle. You can't just have everyone working in high-margin occupations, but that's what everyone wants to do by getting their college degree, and you just need to change expectations, because there's no way, even if you were to go and have all these immigrants come in, there's no way there'd be enough labor, and actually paid labor, okay? Because then there'd still be a lot of job-seeking domestic citizens in addition to job-seeking immigrants. So I say leave the immigrants out, okay, and just prioritize efficient job training and job creation for the jobless in your community. And don't send them off to college so that they get them out of your hair for 4 years, because then they'll come back and they'll have even higher expectations for work. So, no, just get them into the workforce at these entry-level jobs ASAP, and then just tell them to hold off in college until they see where they might actually be promoted if only they had a college degree. Otherwise, if they're never going to be promoted anyway, then the college degree is a moot point. Okay, so a final question from the city of Lodi. How can the director of administration support business development in the city of Lodi? My response: an apolitical expert such as the director of administration can effectively foster economic development by identifying high-value economic activities and building these high-value economic activities via connections, building these connections necessary to bring that business into city limits by affordable means. In other words, okay, now again, limitations prevented me from writing this part in, but it's true because it's played out in many southern states, and that is, you don't want to give extreme property tax concessions in order to attract a small number of jobs. In other words, like, it goes back to the concept of a Laffer curve from economics, and that is that, okay, so like each job created by the tax concession would in turn raise the workers' income taxes, but you have to go and sum those increases to the workers' income tax receipts, right? You sum those and compare that aggregate against the lost property tax receipts from the company. And you also have to keep in mind that a lot of the workers from the newly created jobs will just be leaving the jobs, like lower paid jobs. So the actual tax receipt increase from the income taxes or workers is actually not going to be as large as what it might seem at first glance, because really it's just a marginal change between their former job income tax and their new tax bracket for paying the income tax at the state level. I mean, unless the municipality can have an income tax too, but most municipalities don't. So, of course, property taxes are the most valuable revenue source for most municipalities. I mean, bonds, they only go so far. Just ask Detroit and Oakland. Municipal bonds only go so far, and you need the property tax base. There's really no substitute. So in other words, you don't go throwing out a large portion of the property tax revenues in order to get like only triple-digit jobs. I mean, you have to continue to ride the infrastructure, because without the infrastructure, then others who don't have any job problems, others who are earning big money, can then decide that they're sick of the deteriorating city where they're living and move elsewhere. And then you lose even more property taxes. So So again, that's just something that I have in my blog as an aside to elaborate on what I wrote for my response. But okay, so how would I go about actually implementing it? Right, I laid out my theory of economic development, but how would I actually make it reality? Okay, so although consultation with the mayor and the county council would undoubtedly color the details, a general consensus is that a strong city needs a complementary mix of public and private sector with a dash of nonprofit involvement. So I can say that franchises are easier to sustain than our startups. So I would go and I would just make it attractive to go and have franchises. And this means having enough foot traffic. And so I suppose like a pedestrian-friendly city, and just have people be able to get around and, with less congestion, and make it easier for people to just stop on in for a quick bite to eat instead of like, well, there's a lot of traffic on the road, so I may as well just brown bag it at my desk. Right? Little things like that are cumulative. They add up in the aggregate. So startups are overrated just because I know some have said that Wisconsin is last in startups, but I say that doesn't really matter nearly as much as some would say it does, because startups tend to fail and franchises are steadier. They're more established. They have a brand reputation, and that brand reputation draws money. Now, by comparison, or rather by contrast, these novel businesses threaten not only wary customers who don't know what they're going to get, but also they threaten existing businesses whose customer base might be cannibalized. So the overall goal should be to provide complementary goods and services to provide a greater economic multiplier effect, instead of hyper-specialized in a few verticals. Because when you hyper-specialize, you take an existing market, right, maybe a latent or emerging market, but then you fragment it into niche and micro markets. And then that means the companies in that silo only have subsistence shares in the market. So with the niche market, you can only get by with like maybe one or maybe two dominant players, but then anyone left is just picking up the scraps, and then they have to work a mick job, and that's just a mess. It's tough to run a business when you're also working like a 9-to-5 job too. So the prospect of urban social unrest will make staying within the safe confines of one's community for commercial activities all the more appealing. So, okay, in other words, when we have these reports of rioting and whatever, unrest in urban centers, then of course people will want to stay in the suburbs more, and they'll want to shop there instead of maybe going to the mall in the city. And that will increase local sales. In addition, we need a strong police force to help keep citizens safe. So the obvious protection of police and just having them out there and responding to everything under the broken windows policy is that we promote 24/7 commerce and greater use of community space, because then people feel empowered to actually utilize their pedestrian-friendly city. And by making the city, Lodi or otherwise, into an area of higher cost housing and lower to middle income jobs, we attract more economically mobile residents who might work in nearby Madison, but they live here and pay property taxes to us, thereby drawing money from Madison. And we provide entry-level jobs for teenagers and fallback jobs for those aspiring professionals who somehow cannot get hired in Madison for an actual job that they train for. So those are my answers. Again, I'm going to have them posted online. You can pore over them and learn. I also have a few sources as to like for further reference, you can go and read about the different forms of government. But Lodi, Wisconsin appears to have the strong mayor council government. But there was no question about it. I just, other than what are the roles of the directors, the mayor, and the alderpersons. Really, that's what it boils down to. It's just you have a legislative branch and one executive who leads bureaucrats. That's pretty much what that's all about. Now, as to when I know where they'll be going forward, I'm sure they would call me next week if they were interested in having me interview. But for the sake of public education, I just wanted to put this out there as an example of what probably the one of the most intensive, writing-intensive applications I've done for a municipal manager. Again, my MPA degree is practically worthless, given how I've not been actually invited to interview for any municipal management position. So consider this a warning. Don't major in public administration. Okay, next podcast will be next week. Is it September? Blanking out. September 16th. Well, happy 9/11. Bye.